So with a SimCar 14, we have a special guest, Horace. Go ahead and tell us who we're talking with today.
Yeah, we're very fortunate to have with us today Ossi Oikarinen, who is a actually a somewhat of a celebrity in Finland because he's also the one of the announcers or commentators on the Formula One television broadcasts. But the reason he has this distinguished position is that he himself is a technical director in or has been in Formula One, is still involved in racing today. I'll let him introduce himself more. So, Ossi, thank you for being on the show. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much. Nice to be here with you guys. Like you said, I've been doing motorsports for, well, as a hobby for about 30 years, professionally about 20 years, and I did 14 years of Formula One. And now I work as a technical director on a DTM team, Audi Sport Team Rosberg in Germany. And also, like you said, part of my hobby or my work, I can't really consider as a work, is the commentating of the Formula One races for Finnish television. So, yeah, I managed to keep myself busy nowadays.
So our audience, I think, is global, but I think for many people, DTM is still not a brand they recognize. Can you tell us a bit about what DTM is?
Well, DTM is mainly German-based series, but it is expanding. So DTM is basically, if you like, the saloon car series or a little bit like NASCAR in the sense that we use a lot of homologated parts, and it's mostly in Germany for the premium makes. So likes of Audi, BMW and Mercedes are competing in this series. Now, because of the rules, it is expanding to Japan, and they are dreaming of making a debut also in USA. So, you know, it's basically a looks like a saloon car by its specified racing car with the carbon fiber chassis and carbon fiber bodies.
Right. It's sometimes called a silhouette series because you have the silhouette of a car that people can recognize so they can see the brand name and they can see the sort of design style, the design language of the car and recognize it as such. And you'll see your Audi and you're looking different than a BMW or a Mercedes. And then and it seems as if there's rivalry between those brands, and yet underneath the skin, it's a completely bespoke, custom-built racing car.
Correct, yes. I mean, the chassis is the same for all the manufacturers, which makes it economically, let's say, affordable for the manufacturers to be involved in it. It by no means it is a cheap series, but still, in the scales of motorsports and compared to, let's say, to Formula One, it's still affordable. And, you know, the manufacturers can buy a lot of standard items to a car, thus it's easier to enter that series.
Right. In fact, I think that's become the logic of NASCAR as well, because the underpinnings of the vehicles are all the same, probably more homogenized in NASCAR than in DTM. But you essentially do differentiate on the engine, I suppose. Is that true?
Well, the biggest differentiator for this series is the engine and the aerodynamics. So those are the two areas where you have freedom. Mm-hmm. And a little bit about the geometry, so the suspension geometry. Those are the areas where you have to do the difference. Mm-hmm. Like I said, the chassis, the fuel tanks, the brakes, the electronics, that's all the same for the manufacturers. So I think they have managed to create the series where there's a good competition without wasting too much money on it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Money is a critical issue, I think, in racing generally, and from the point of view of the manufacturer. But before we get into the money, a few more questions about your role. Can you explain what does technical director mean and what are perhaps the other important management roles in the team?
Well, technical director is basically responsible for the whole technical side of the operation. On the other side, we have the team manager who's responsible for the mechanics and for the logistics of the team. And obviously, on top of these two guys, there's the team principal. As my role of the technical director, I have two race engineers who are each responsible for one of the racing cars. Then there's two data engineers, one responsible for one each car, and then two simulation engineers plus two guys for strategy. So basically, I run the engineering side of the operation, if you like.
Wow, really impressive. Now, how, can you relate these numbers to what a Formula One team would have in terms of staffing?
Well, I mean, a DTM team, because we don't manufacture anything as a customer team or works team. We don't manufacture anything ourselves, so we can be a fairly small operation. Our team is in total 26 people. Now, the smallest Formula One team probably employs about 200 people, but you have to remember they have also a manufacturing operation. I would say probably a normal Formula One team race operation would be around 60 people. So, you know, if we bring to a race circuit about 20 people, then that gives you a little bit of a idea of the relation of the
manpower needed. So at least 10 times more people in terms of the whole organization, and then you have probably in terms of people brought to the team, I mean to the race, you have about three times as many.
Well, yes, but then again, like I said, you have to remember that in the Formula One, they do have to manufacture their own
cars. Sure, sure.
We get our cars provided by the Autosport.
And what is the business model? Can you explain a little bit to, if it's not a secret, how do teams like Team Rosberg or let's say even in Formula One Ferrari, how do they make money from the racing itself? Is it sponsorship? Do they have a percentage of revenues from television rights, combination of the two?
Well, I think the business model for a DTM team is quite different from a Formula One team. Formula One teams, traditionally, they make their money out of the sponsorship and from the TV money. And that's the combination, how they make their income. In DTM, because we are a service provider for the manufacturers like Audi, normally the manufacturer brings in the sponsorship with them and provides us with the budget to run the cars. So the business model is quite different in the DTM than it's in the Formula One. Also, the budgets are a lot smaller than they are in Formula One.
In DTM, the money comes from the manufacturer, let's say Audi. Is that what you said?
Yes, correct. So the Audi Sport provides us with the budget, and within that budget, we have to operate.
I see. And do you have bonuses if you do better?
Well, that's obviously a business secret, so I'd love to tell you, but I can't tell you.
Okay, great. Good to know. So that's fascinating. I mean, sorry for all the silly questions, but we tend to be more technically minded and not so much aware of the of some of the business issues, and I think that's what we're trying to explore more. The reason I ask also is because I think that the history of motor racing as a business has been very curious. This past weekend I was at the Montreal race, Grand Prix du Canada, and seeing the event live. It's very different than seeing it on TV, but also it's important to understand that the revenue in Formula One used to be almost entirely from the live events, and therefore one would pay the track owner, and there were no television rights back in the day because it started 100 years ago. And only since the 1970s or so did we actually have the infusion of money from television rights, and that changed the business dramatically. I think that was something that was illustrated very well in the movies that came out last year. Not movies. There was, of course, Rush, which told the story of the rivalry of two drivers in that era, but also there was a movie or film called One about the bigger picture of what racing was about back in then. So just give us an idea of how big the business is now and where the revenues come from, and how do people. We hear so much about Bernie Ecclestone and the empire he built, but how does it all work?
Well, I mean, this is a fascinating topic. In the end of the day, we know some of it, but not all of it, because obviously Bernie keeps the cards very close to his chest. On the numbers which are available for the public, in 2012, I think Formula One crossed something like 1.1 billion euros annually, and the budgets of the teams, they vary between 40 and 400 million euros per year. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of the magnitude of the business where the Formula One is at the moment. As for the money making, obviously some of the big sponsors, they put good money into the business, but again, the numbers are well kept secrets. And all the race organizers, they pay for Bernie to hold the races, some more than the others. Some are paid by the countries and the government, some are paid by the organizers. And they pay money for organizing the race and then obviously collect the ticket income themselves.
Sorry, go ahead.
And the big money is obviously on the TV, because TV rights, that's the one big selling point for the for whole Formula One operation.
Yeah, the clue came to me when I watched this film, One, and it was shown, I was on a plane, I was flying, and I saw the movie Rush, and right after it, I saw this film, One, which was very impressive, because they were talking about the same thing, but one was a work of fiction, and one, sorry, oop, there's a little noise. One was a work, not of fiction, but it was a dramatized dramatized telling of the era, and then the other was more of a documentary. An interesting point made in One was how there was a time when this business was mainly manufacturers spending money in order to essentially build their brand and somewhat get some sponsorship. But the track owners were generating most of the revenue, and then the television guys came and said, "We'd like to show this on TV." And it was Bernie who suggested that they acquire the rights or aggregate the rights and sell them to the TV guys, and he needed some millions of dollars to do so, and offered the option to the manufacturers to say, "Please, would you like to come in on this?" And their budgets were so tight, or they were spending so much on R&D, that they couldn't afford to get in on that deal. And eventually that's how he ended up with the rights, which I suppose over time had been renegotiated. But that was the crucial point in time when the business as we know it today of Formula One began, when the TV money came in. So it's really, really complicated. I think that I've seen before some analysis of trying to explain it with some block diagrams. And it was really confusing as to know where the money comes and where it goes. Because obviously for tax reasons also, authorities are very curious about how the machine operates. So I don't think there's a simple answer to that. But what's your take? Is it something that's the most brilliant business idea ever, or is it more of an accident?
Well, I think Bernie's been always, he's been a brilliant businessman in the sense of sensing where to make money. I mean, he used to be a used car salesman, and his business dealings, what I've gathered, have been fairly ruthless and to a point. So he's always been good at gathering the money and making good business for himself. So for him to get the TV rights and then later on getting the 100-year deal and exclusive rights for the television from FIA, those were the big main points where he could clinch the deal and basically go on with this business. But I think there's been so many stories and so many books written about Bernie and how he's been dealing, and whether everything's told or not, that's something which is very fascinating. And that I don't know, or I don't think we even know half the good stories. So, it's a very interesting subject.
Indeed, indeed. So back to the technical aspects, the fascinating thing, I think, we coming from technology world, is just how dependent the sport has become on technology. And it's not just, I mean, it's always been dependent on technology. I mean, certainly the engineering behind the racing vehicles has been just fascinating for generations, and this is why probably the sport has had such a great success with young and old alike. But the question I have is more, now we've gotten into digital technologies and somewhat the car industry, the industry that serves consumers, I should say, has been, we feel, a little bit lagging in adopting some of the latest things. They eventually get it, but it's taken a while for certain digital technology and certain entertainment technologies to get into cars. And that's something a bit of a theme for our show, that how long does it take for, let's say, smartphones and things of that nature to become fully integrated into the car. But in Formula One, I think their adoption has been very, very rapid. So can you give us examples of how really the innovation race is going on in motorsport? Maybe some forms of it are less than others, but I think maybe, I don't know where to begin even. Is it with a budget, or is it more to show some examples of how the latest technology is used by the organization of the FIA, or to define the formula, or how the teams sometimes take a leap and implement things, and how much leeway there is for them to do so?
Well, I think one very good example is the kinetic energy recovery systems, which came in 2009 to the Formula One cars. It was written in regulation some time before that system would be available, and we started developing the systems in 2008. We did not have much of an idea how to do that in the first place. So, you know, electricity and batteries, they were not usually the big part of the Formula One car. And all of a sudden, we had to learn how to put these energy recovery systems in the car, how to put the batteries, what kind of battery technology we had to have. And the learning curve was very steep, and very rapidly you had to learn everything about this and develop the car. And one thing which is probably not so commonly known, but it's not a very easy combination to put the carbon fiber and the electricity together. And we had some big issues in the beginning trying to understand how that functions. And even the experienced guys from the streetcar side who had hybrid car experience could not explain all the things which were happening with the whole system. So, you know, that was one of the points where you just very fast had to learn how to use the system, because it
can you give us a sort of just a quick 2 minutes on the KERS system? Just what is it for and how does it work?
Well, KERS system, it's basically a kinetic energy recovery system. So every time you brake with the Formula One car, you have basically, you are creating electricity with an electrical motor from the rear axle. So part of the braking force is coming from this electrical motor, which is then collecting the energy into the battery. And whenever you go and accelerate with the car, you can then use this electrical energy to accelerate the car faster. And nowadays the energy level is at 160 horsepower. So we're talking about quite significant amount of energy which is going to the rear wheels and coming from the rear wheels. So that's the KERS system.
So it's basically a hybrid system. You harvest energy during braking and then release it during acceleration, thus wasting less through heat and other forces that are dissipated during friction braking, and that seems very logical to you know, that's the logic behind a lot of electric or hybrid cars today. But to put that into use on a machine that runs at such speeds and such forces generated, it's just phenomenal. Things happen in milliseconds. And so you don't really have a long time to harvest this energy or a long time to release it. So things have to be amplified by a huge margin, I would imagine.
Well, not only that, but the learning curve had to be fairly fast, because in the end of the day, we had to prepare from the running prototype to the racing in about, well, less than 1 year. We did never have the luxury of falling back and saying we'll introduce that for the next year. We had to have the system running, and that time constraint is quite unique, because in the street car business, at least you can delay the system if you're not 100% happy with it. But we did not have any choice. We had to come up with it, and we had to make it work very fast. So,
At the time, you were with which team?
At time, I was with the BMW Sauber, and then I went to Ferrari. So, you know, I saw in both places how the system was developed.
And so much of this is driven by regulation, but do you also try to innovate and try to bring technologies into the framework of the racing on your own? Do you look at let's say certain electronics or certain types of sensors or things of that nature that are unique to each team, or is everybody really playing exactly the same game?
No, I mean, every team is obviously trying to get the edge where they can. So if there's new inventions in material technology or in, say, in a battery technology or nowadays with the lubricants with your oil and fuel manufacturer, you're talking about small details and you're talking about small margins. But Formula One is all about small details, and you're trying to get the edge where you can. So if your, say, oil supplier comes up with a new good idea for your engine, then obviously you will use that edge. And same if there's a new invention in the material technology or in manufacturing, which can be used to your benefit, then obviously you're trying to use it as soon as possible.
Now, you mentioned Sauber and Ferrari. Sauber is known as a German brand, I believe, right?
Well, they're Swiss. Yes.
Or Swiss, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And Ferrari is, of course, Italian. But are these teams based primarily in those countries? Or because we hear a lot about the English dominance of constructors, brands, and so on. How much concentration is there of expertise in one place in Formula One?
Well, England is the big place for that, because if you draw a circle around Oxford, I think you can fit seven teams into that, and the rest of the teams, which are Ferrari, Sauber, and Toro Rosso, outside of the outside of this circle. But I think most of the teams, like I said, are there, but also a lot of the suppliers are concentrated in UK. Mm-hmm. So I think it's easiest for a Formula One team to exist there.
That's interesting how things concentrate. English have taken the leadership also, I believe, in many in supplying many other car racing motorsport activities. And I think Indy cars are also made there, if I'm remembering correctly.
I have a quick question, Ossie. As you think about the arc of your career, and you talk about the Kerr system, how many of these things have had a material effect on the performance? You know, I mean, these are things technologists look at all the time and say, well, does it matter? And are you forced to do certain things because of regulations? And then which ones matter? How do you decide?
Well, obviously, the usual path in Formula One is to go through the simulation. So first, when there's a new set of regulations, you will evaluate it, you know, how much, like in a Kerr system case, on those days in 2008, first you had to do the simulation, how much the weight is going to cost you time. So what's the disadvantage of it and how much can you gain from it? And from pretty early days on, it was fairly clear that with the functioning system or with well-functioning system, you can gain time. So the decision was quite easy.
Mm. But again, sometimes you're just forced to a formula. So you have the constraints of tire, you have the constraints of rules like fuel consumption, you have the constraints of engine configuration, and I'm just I find it completely mind-boggling to think that from year to year you have to redesign so much of the car because of these rules. And one couldn't imagine being you know, forced to such a degree of change in other industries. I mean, consumers certainly force and competition forces change, but here you have essentially a regulatory body telling you what you can and cannot do. How much input can a manufacturer have into this process? Is there any way of shaping the decision process that goes into a regulation?
Well, there is a process to change the regulations if needed, but usually the bigger changes, like for this season when V6 turbo engines were introduced and the 100 kilos per race fuel limit were introduced, that comes from FIA, and usually to those kind of decisions it's difficult to say much. They were talking about putting a inline four-cylinder engine into the cars, but some of the manufacturers said, for image reasons, it's better to have a V6 engine. So, because it's a more sporty engine than inline four. So, for the image reasons, sometimes there's small changes in rules and regulations. So, yes, you can sometimes affect the regulations, but when the big decision is done, then you have to go with it.
So just for our audience who may not be familiar, the current regulations are, I believe, is it 1.6 liter maximum displacement?
Yeah, 1.6 liter V6 turbo engine.
And the turbo allows us to get the higher horsepower needed, because in years past, we had configurations that would limit it to, let's say, 3 liters, and people would configure the engines with either V8 or V10. Occasionally, I think V12. But normally aspirated, so there were turbos were actually banned. So some years we see turbos required and others banned. And so this is what I mean about the having to completely reconfigure the car. And what kind of horsepower do they get at 1.6 liters today?
Well, the talk is obviously we don't know the exact numbers, because all the manufacturers will keep the cards close to their chests, but the talk is about 600 horsepower nowadays from the 1.6 liter engine, which is revving about 12,500 RPM at the moment. So that's the power you get, plus then the hybrid system, 160 horsepower on top of it. So, you know, 750 horsepower, 760 horsepower is not a bad output for such a machine.
Peak. But can you use the KERS system all the time? Isn't there a rule about not being allowed to use the boost?
Well, there is also the regulation for the KERS system that you can use it for 33 seconds during a lap. So it's actually quite a lot of time, but not all the time, like you said. So there's rules and regulations and limitations for usage of the power.
And the industry, when I was in the Grand Prix in Canada, they had a couple of races prior to the main event, and one of those was looking at vintage Formula One cars racing. This was obviously for the entertainment, and it was kind of just a few laps, but it was stunning to see these older vintage cars and the amount of power they had because of the noise they made relative to the newer cars. The newer cars didn't sound so loud anymore. I remember when I went in the 90s that the noise was visceral. It was just like it would grab you and scare you to death. But nowadays they seem more subdued. So were there years when there was almost an unrestricted feel to the power of the engines, and how was that like, and what did that imply for the sport?
Well, I think, you know, if you come back to the noise, I mean, personally, I'm much happier with the quieter cars, because in the end of the day, my ears used to ring after the race weekend, so I'm happier with the quieter cars. But I do also understand the people who want to have a noisier car and see that as a part of the spectacle, if you like, from the races. Because if I go and see drag racing, for example, NHRA, you know, top fuelers or the funny cars, it's the nitro engines and the sound which they make which is important for me. So I can sympathize with that. But, you know, Formula One is also about going forward. Formula One is about developing the technology and being on a top of the technology development curve. So, you know, that's where we're going nowadays. We're going to hybrid cars and a little bit quieter cars. So that's part of it. So, you know, I don't have a problem with it, and I've been always happy with the change.
And just on a slight different tangent now, marketing or sort of perception of the sport. What's impressive about it, I think, Formula One in particular, is how let's say, for lack of a better word, sexy it is. And this is something that I've struggled with because it seems as if it appeals to multiple parts of your brain. It appeals to the technical minded because it is indeed a challenging technical problem, and you want to see competition in that regard. But it's also appealing on a fundamental sort of visceral level, much like a gladiator sport might, where you have combat between heroic figures. So that's the driver's competition, and people side with them and sort of become very tribal about who they support. There's also national competition, so you might support a team because of the nation state behind them. You might be a fan of the brands, so you might be following a certain manufacturer. And then there's the simply the attractiveness of it all because it is so sexy in the sense of sort of the combination of these things. The thing that comes to mind is when walking around Montreal, I stumbled upon the place where Ferrari was having a party, and this was in a hotel where they had booked it, they had placed in front of the hotel about a dozen late model Ferraris, including a Formula One. Their version of sort of the Challenge series cars, and they were just so all these beautiful people in the party outside taking photos with the cars. And I thought, what is it about this sport that attracts this sense of sex appeal and sophistication? It doesn't seem to be the case for, let's say, I can't imagine what sport has the same appeal. I'm just wondering what your thoughts on how did that come to be?
I think you nailed it very well. I mean, the one thing I'd like to add to it is the emotion also, because you see big emotions also in the racing, because it's, like you said, it's the modern day gladiators, they go head to head, and they bang wheels sometimes, and there's a lot of emotions also in it. So I think that makes for great entertainment. There's the supporting the team, there's the supporting maybe the driver, and then the emotions we see through the race, and the highs and lows which these guys go through, and we live with them. So I think it's the whole package of the different emotions.
And it appeals to men and women. I think that's the amazing thing. A lot of sport is usually, gender specific. But in this case, we have, in my family at least, my wife and my mother-in-law are bigger fans than I am. I used to be more, but I think that I've become less so in the years, in my older years. But they still really follow it, and especially because they're Finnish, and that means that they follow the Finnish racers. So they're not so much fans of, let's say, Lotus or McLaren, as you might be, let's say, because you grew up with those names. But they follow the Finnish racers, the drivers themselves, who are legends in their own countries. And Finns have had a long history with the sport. certainly, they seem to have had a driver in the series almost every year. Any ideas why that might be, by the way? Why are Finns so good at Formula One?
Well, I think one thing which is important to remember is that we have plenty of places to practice, although the summer is relatively short here, but there's a lot of go-kart circuits and you can drive a lot on those. So the pyramid, what you need in order to develop one top-level driver, the pyramid is fairly large on the bottom of it, and there's a lot of talent and there's a lot of young drivers in Finland, so the practice possibilities are good. And from that side of on, it's that's how you develop talent. So out of 10,000 good go-kart racers, maybe you get one which might make it to higher formulas. So that's one part of it. The other part of it is that in Finland people tend to be fairly single-minded once they want to do well in the sports, because it's a small country, only 5 million people. So if you want to make it from here, then obviously you have to give your best and you give it all to make it into Formula One. So the guys who make it, they tend to be characters who are willing to go all the way and push for the maximum to achieve their dreams.
There, it's not just Formula One. It's in rally. It's in DTM, as you point out. I think there's a racing. By the way, having driven there, I didn't think that drivers are particularly aggressive. They're very, very calm relative to other countries I've driven in. So they obey the rules, and it's a fairly civilized place to drive as a consumer. But they do have this passion for racing, and there's an old saying, you know, if you want to win, employ a Finn. That's been used in Formula or in motorsport for so many decades. Your relationship with drivers, just curious about that for a minute. You've met and worked with a lot of superstars. What is it like? And are they really a different type of person? Are they a different breed apart?
Well, I think during my years, I have to calculate it for one interview, and I worked with 24 different race drivers and 12 test drivers in Formula One. So, yeah, I think I have a fairly good idea. I mean, these guys are dedicated to their job. That's the number one thing. And the number two thing is that they are very focused on winning and doing their best. So they're not necessarily easy individuals to work with, and they're not very relaxed when it comes to working, but you know, outside of the working hours, they could be just like anybody else, you know, relaxed. But when it comes to working, then they're very focused and very demanding, because I think it's the only way to be if you want to be a winning sports personality. Well, in any discipline for that matter. But, you know, they're very demanding. But that's also good, because usually it makes yourself to up your game when you work with these guys. So I think it's been very interesting and very rewarding experience, at least for me personally.
But Aussie, what difference in the, again, looking at, across those 24 drivers and 12 test drivers, I guess you said, what difference does the organization make? We've talked in terms of the auto industry and also technology in the past about the team, the management, the structure of the organization. Is that decisive? You know, how have you viewed that?
Well, in Formula One, it is decisive, because in the end of the day, let it be the best drivers, say Alonso, Raikkonen, Hamilton, Rosberg, they could not win in the worst car, no matter how hard they try. So for these guys, in order to win, they obviously need a good team behind of them, and that's really the number one thing. Obviously, all the drivers are trying to get to the best team and guess what team is going to be the best in, say, 2 years' time, in order to be in the right place in the right time.
But what distinguishes the organization structure or the people? With, you know, in your experience, what makes it go? What makes one better than the other?
Well, I think it's, first of all, the reaction to the changes. That's the number one, because if there's rule changes, that they can react quickly and be on top of the development. The other one is obviously then being able to make the quick racing car, and that's not so easy. I mean, I've seen some really good operations, yet they weren't the winning operations. And I've seen some medium operations which were winning then on their day. So, you know, it's not so easy to just say, do this and you'll be a winning organization.
And how about the participation of the manufacturers across the arc of your career? Certainly in the States, they seem to come and go. The Detroit-based companies... do you see that changing, and has it been good or bad for the sport, or how has that done?
Well, I mean, Formula One, there's been some manufacturers which been there, and, you know, like you said, they come and go. For example, Toyota, Honda, BMW. They've been in the sport and they've gone. But then there's manufacturers which are like Mercedes and Ferrari who are there for the long haul. So I think the manufacturer involvement is always good for the sport, because in the end of the day, they bring a lot of know-how with them. The bad thing is obviously if they all of a sudden decide to go and close the team up. So, you know, it's a bit of a double-sided sword, if you like. So there's good and bad in it.
And do you see that they often reap technical benefits, or is it strictly a marketing game these days for them?
I wouldn't say it's strictly a marketing game for them. I mean, mostly, yes, but also there's, especially now with the new engines, there's definitely lessons for them to learn also, and also in the material technology. So I think there's an interchange both ways.
Yeah, it's interesting. Horace and I have talked about the slow pace of the legacy manufacturers, you know, vis-a-vis Tesla and some others, or Toyota's hybrids. Especially the Germans, they seem to be now adding hybrids for better or worse. So that's interesting. So you do see some technical transfer.
Yeah, of course. I mean, these are the things which might come to the top level cars first, and then slowly get to the, let's say, normal level cars. Mm-hmm. So that's very normal.
How much does the driver? So again, across the arc of your career, how much has been taken away from the driver?
Well, depending on the rules, sometimes the driver had more control, sometimes less. But I think at the modern day Formula One, they have still a big effect on the result, and their influence is still the biggest on the performance.
So even with all the software, because you can imagine, I mean, now that the new Golf GTI, for example, has quite a bit of software around applying brakes for better performance in the corners and all sorts of things like that, you know, take it away somewhat controversially from the driver. And obviously there are lots of other cars that have that as well. So in Formula One, you know, is the application of software, is that becoming more important in terms of race performance, or is it just another tool?
Well, I think it's a tool, because in the end of the day, a lot of these intelligent systems are banned in Formula One. So you cannot have traction control, and you cannot have systems which would help the driver too much, like stability control, anti-lock brakes, and all these are banned.
Right. Huh.
So you can only go so far with the software, and rest the driver has to do.
Right. There were times when again, this is the software became available and systems became available, and Formula One teams started to implement them, and then the regulations came in and banned them. So over the years, there's been this cat and mouse game where a manufacturer would try something new and then it would be quickly banned. Not just in electrical or electronics or software, but also in mechanical solutions, like using a fan to create downforce.
Right. Famous example, yes.
Yeah, and or six wheels. There was a six-wheeled racing car, for some season where they assumed that. The having two sets of front steering would somehow improve the performance. But that nowadays, I think almost everything is scrutinized and everything is under control to some degree by the organizations. Stepping back one more time to kind of looking at the individuals involved. You're currently working at Team Rosberg, and that's named after the legend Keke Rosberg, and he was in Formula One during, I think, the 80s, so he seems to have stuck with the sport in some capacity, not as a driver, but as a manager or as a team owner. Do you see that tendency to become? A manager common? Is that a common ambition, or is it simply the individual is more inclined to graduate or to sort of retire into it later on? How do you see that post-race career developing for some drivers, or is there a pattern we can see there?
Well, I think the pattern is not there, because I think there's so many different post-racing careers. I think Keke is a very good example of an ex-world champion who turns into a businessman who's then managing drivers, doing his own racing team. I think Keke as a character is such a character that he can't sit still for 2 minutes unless he's doing something. So, you know, that's just his character. There's other drivers, who became also team owners, like Andretti, for example. in the US, and then there's other drivers who just simply walk away from it and decide to do something completely different in their life, you know, become a farmer or just, you know, do things quietly in the background. So I think there's no set pattern for the drivers, you know, what they do after their racing.
Yeah.
Like there isn't a set pattern what they did before they became a racing driver.
Interesting. Yeah, because we sometimes hear about some of the legendary, even Lauda, who after Formula One became an airline, you know, founder, and there are many who stayed in the sport, but others who actually became successful in other businesses after their motorsport years. And I'm always fascinated by the logic of kind of being, on one hand, a great man of execution, a great performer, switching to a role where they are a great leader. And sometimes, like, I think Schumacher, for example, while he was a driver, he was a leader. And that's also a very rare combination, because we tend to think that individuals are either, because you have limited time, you can focus on only one thing. So if you focus on the thing you're best at, and you may be best at being a racing driver, but who has time to learn the intricacies of management or the intricacies of leadership and having people follow you and inspiring others? And yet some very few have these dual capabilities of great at execution, but also at the same time having a second set of skills. And again, we may be just remembering these outliers more than we do the average driver. But I think it's a fascinating story there, how this happens.
I think if you look at, for example, Keke, he used to negotiate his own contracts always. So, you know, for him, it was kind of natural to become a driver manager.
Yeah.
He knew how it was done, also how sponsorship deals went down. So I think it was a logical step for him to do this. So, you know, it was nothing new for him. Basically, he was doing the same thing as before, just not the part of driving. So, you know, that's part of the development.
And by the way, just the same thought I was having in terms of, you know, in some other talent-oriented industries, like even in acting, you have a few people who go from being a great actor to becoming a director or even moving into a completely different area. Like if you think of Schwarzenegger, who went from being a bodybuilder to being the governor of California. I mean, that's a huge, huge change in skill. Anyway, it's fascinating. I think this is a conversation we could keep having for hours and hours. I think it was a great first interview, and thanks for coming. One more thing, you yourself are obviously multi talented, so you're a technical director, and you're commentating for television. Is that something you found easy, or is it something that that you had to practice for?
Well, I found it very easy because in the end of the day, we have different commentating roles. We have Oscar Isari, who's producing the talk and the commentary for the Finnish television, and my role is more to give the expert side of the story and tell about the strategies and all this. So I'm just basically telling what I see and what I've used to do anyhow. So, you know, for me, it was very easy, easy step to do this. And actually, it's very interesting because it gives you a completely different side of the pitfall and different view to the whole sport. So I enjoy doing it a lot, and it's good fun.
Are you doing it nowadays from a studio, or are you on site at any time?
Unfortunately, due to the time, because I still need to do the DTM, which is my main job, so I cannot travel to the races, so I have to do it from a studio. But thanks to the modern technology, it's not really an issue to do it that way.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, from the viewer's point of view, the sad part, from my point of view, is how the Formula One is actually no longer freely available to all viewers. The television rights are quite quite complicated. And to put it nicely, in Finland in particular, we don't have access to Formula One live on without pay per view. I think, is that correct?
At the moment, yes.
Yes. So my wife has subscribed to it, but I find it a little frustrating that we've gotten to the point where this is more of a pay-per-view type model, but in some countries it isn't yet. So, what's your take on that? Just curious if you want to comment. I mean, do you think that this is a good thing or a bad thing or neither one?
Well, I think it's also a sign of times, because in the end of the day, if you think of how the media is evolving at the, you know, in a modern day, it's more focused on its audience, and there's more pay-per-view services, if you like. Because in the end of the day, there used to be only a couple of TV stations, and they used to be then financed with the adverts. And nowadays, we don't have any adverts in, for example, during the Formula One. So the money for that has to come from somewhere else. And then again, if I want to watch movies, I pay for it at the moment. So, you know, I'm not watching free movies from a telly anymore. I view movies, you know, pay by demand services. Yeah. So I think it's a kind of a sign of the times, mm-hmm. you know, how it goes. And still, we're not talking about huge amount of money. So it's not like, you know, they're doing a daylight robbery with the prices for the whole F1 season.
Well, so how is attendance across these different events? Obviously, Formula One's quite popular, but what about the DTM series, Ossie?
Well, DTM, because the way it's done, I mean, it's paid by the manufacturers, so they want to keep it free in the free television, and that's a different philosophy of doing the broadcasting. So for them, it's important that it's a free fall.
Yeah, because the concern I have is more for the younger people, the children, if you will. They're the future viewers, and if you're going to tie things up in pay per view, then you only get the enthusiasts paying, and so young people may just simply not be exposed to this. And that's why I'm concerned about that, and it might be just detrimental to the long term of the business. It may make sense now. But in the long term, you don't have this kind of wild enthusiasm that children, my generation had about this sport, that you could tune in on a Sunday and freely watch the sport and so on. I don't know. I'm not an expert on this. I'm just curious whether this has implications.
Well, I mean, we still show the races for free on a telly, so that's not gone all not only live, but you know, they're shown later on.
There's delays,
and there's still there's a still fair amount of information coming through the sport broadcast, so it's not banished from the free TV first of all. And I think also it's not only Formula One, but it's also the other sports which are going through the similar phases. I think it's a valid concern what you said. How are the younger generations going to find this? But then again, I think we have so many different channels where this Formula One can be found, will be found. Mm-hmm. You know, let it be then YouTube or whatever, where the manufacturers and teams are putting up clips. So yes and no. It's maybe not so much mainstream, but the information and the races are still easily available if you wish. So. It's a new challenge for everybody, like anything else nowadays. You know, world is changing, digital media is changing. So I think we have many other challenges also, but, I don't think we're going to vanish anywhere. So
what about DTM attendance at the track? Is it good or bad or similar? What do you sense with that? I'm thinking about in the U.S. NASCAR, right, which continues to be quite popular. How's DTM?
Well, DTM in Germany is very well attended, because the manufacturers want to keep the ticket prices so low that whole family can afford to be there. Mm. And also, we are making the show for the audience, so, you know, the paddocks are open and the people can get easily to meet the drivers. So, you know, it's built for the audience and it's built for the media. So we're trying to make our best to, be popular. And I think DTM is succeeding very well on it.
Wow. Well, this is such a great interview, and I think yes. such a lot of information that we're going to have to digest. And thank you again so much for the time. We'll be probably having a couple of shows just to go over some of the things you told us. Without any other reason
it's been a good conversation. We very yeah. much appreciate it today, Ossie, and
well,
best wishes
you
with your team and your broadcasting career.